The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the Yes And moment in your work and in your life. Yes And is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Colin M. Fisher. Colin is a scholar, author, and teacher of team leadership, creativity, and improvisation. As an assistant professor and lecturer of organizations and innovation at University College London, Colin teaches executives, graduate students, and undergraduates about leading teams that foster creativity, learning, and effective decision-making. Colin received his PhD in organizational behavior and MA in social psychology from Harvard University, Harvard Business School. He also studied improvisation in the arts at New York University and jazz trumpet at New England Conservatory of Music. In his work as a professional jazz trumpet player, Colin was a longtime member of the Grammy-nominated Either Orchestra, with whom he toured the U.S., Europe, and Africa, and recorded several critically acclaimed albums. Colin Fisher, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Kelly.
So you wrote a paper in 2009 about creativity, improvisation, and organizations. And part of what seemed to interest you at the time is that most studies on creativity, in business at least, were about creative individuals. But you write that, quote, lone creators appear increasingly anachronistic as teams and larger groups and organizations become the dominant mode through which progress is made in much of the world, end quote. So there's been a shift here, right?
Yeah, there's a shift possibly in what's really happening, or it could just be a shift in how we're telling the stories. And it was always the case that creative endeavors were collaborative endeavors, and probably a lot more improvisational than people were willing to admit, especially in organizations where there's a big premium on rationality and planning and strategy. And so I think sometimes people are maybe not giving improvisation its due in its role in creativity in organizations.
It's also hard, I think, what I've discovered in academia is there's not a lot of research on successful, effective, creative teams, you know, teams that have been together a long time. It's most of the work, it's easier, I think, to study individuals or, you know, you're studying random groups of people come together. Mm-hmm. And so that, it feels like that's got to be an emerging sort of source of literature because it doesn't seem like a lot exists right now.
Yeah, you're definitely right that it's a lot harder to study groups, because especially if you want to do any kind of quantitative analysis where you just need a lot more people to have a lot of groups than you do to study a lot of individuals. I'm sorry, I forgot. I lost the thread of.
That's okay.
I want to jump to
something that also appears in the paper, because you talk about the Tylenol crisis, and that hit home for us at Second City because the Walgreens store where some of the poison pills were purchased is directly across the street from Second City at North and Wells. And people are often surprised at the idea of attaching improvisation to moments of crisis, but that actually is a thing. I mean, indeed, I think the moments of crisis where you want the ability to be able to improvise.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think the Tylenol crisis is a good example because, you know, that was before we had Twitter or real-time information coming in. And so, you know, these people at Tylenol were trying to make decisions with, you know, just minimal information. And they had to act and see what the results of that were, and sort of feel their way through blindly. And it was almost impossible to plan under those kinds of conditions. And, you know, as we were saying at the beginning, it's almost like people and organizations need to have a crisis in order to improvise,
right,
to sort of give themselves permission to do it. And so it's descriptively true that we see improvisation in organizations in moments of crises. You know, I wouldn't say more often, but certainly that's a big trigger for improvising.
It's
I'm
almost
not sure.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm not sure it needs to be that way, but I think it certainly is that way right now.
Well, yeah, I think what you're talking about is it would help if there was the ability to practice crisis mm-hmm. management. Right. And what we don't do a lot of times in our businesses, we work so hard to eradicate any level of failure that we're sometimes doing ourselves a disservice to be able to sort of figure out what to do in those moments when things don't go right.
Yeah, absolutely. But I almost think it's a misnomer to think that eradicating failure means that we shouldn't improvise, because that's sort of saying that if people were improvising, then they wouldn't be able to find their way through, and that actually routines are going to be better, that if we have a really big handbook of every mistake you could possibly make and you have a decision tree to make sure you don't make them and you know what to do in every situation, I'm not sure that's better, because we see that in things like the airline industry, where they have, every time there's an airline incident, they add another page to the handbook that says how you handle that particular kind. And what ends up happening is everyone ignores the book.
Right.
And so it's not necessarily that you get better outcomes by saying, oh, we're not going to improvise. So I think it still remains to be seen if we had a lot of organizations that took that seriously. Certainly in the military and in law enforcement and people who know they have to expect the unexpected, you do get some organizations that really organize around being able to improvise, mm-hmm. but it's certainly not the norm. If you sort of believe the rhetoric that the world is changing a lot faster, information is so overwhelming that we're going to have to work with more unknowns, then it might not just be them that needs to be thinking about this.
I always love talking to people who have experience in improvisation, but different than mine. Mm-hmm. I've worked almost strictly from sort of theatrical improvisation. You have both a sort of academic understanding, but also as a musician. And we did a project with Hubbard Street Dance a couple years back, and I didn't realize at that time that most modern dance is all improvised. But it's a slightly different language. So one of the things that we know, and you talk about this in this paper, is that improvisation allows you to separate analysis from action. And you use these words because you talk about the unique role of, quote, novelty and time. And I want you to sort of unpack that a little bit. What does that mean?
So part of it is just establishing, what are we comparing improvisation to?
Yeah.
And one thing we can compare it to is routine or habitual action. So we can, have a store of things that we know how to do that we do really frequently, and we can just sort of pull them out one at a time. And so the novelty part is contrasting improvisation with that kind of routine action. But then on the temporal dimension, and this is what we talk about in the paper when we're talking about creativity and improvisation, is, you can do things where what you're making, if you're making something creative, is something that you can step out of the moment of creating it. So if we're talking about a long R&D process, we're talking about the process of making a movie, or even the design process at these design firms like IDEO. Those are things where you're making something physical. You can leave it alone. You can change what you did in the past, and it doesn't necessarily affect what you're going to do in the future. And so the time aspect is to say, when you're improvising, what you're doing can't be undone. There's not this ability to revise anything. There's not an ability to stop and say, hey, wait a minute, let me get more information or get some new skills or resources before we go on. You have to just keep moving and work with the consequences of each action. And that really changes both the experience and the consequence of improvising compared to a more what we call compositional creative process.
Yeah, it upsets the context in kind of a beautiful way. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I often talk about with people at Second City is, the structure of an evening at Second City is a two-act scripted review that was written through the improvisational process, but mostly is scripted. And then a third mm-hmm. act, late night, where we're just improvising. And when we're not writing a new show, we're playing games and we're goofing around and trying different stuff. And often people say to me, my favorite part was the improv part at the end. And I'm like, that's hilarious. hilarious because we failed so much more in that part. But you understood from the audience that the context was different simply because you understood that they were sort of making it up. It's also late at night, so we sort of, you know, it's free. We've set up the rules slightly differently. But when you start to think about the creative act, you can't just think about it as a standalone because it does involve time is essential in so many different ways.
Definitely. And, you know, I think in the arts, you know, of sort of putting on a different hat than the business school professor one, you know, it's hard to organize, it's hard to analyze composed performances with the same kind of standards as improvised performances.
Right.
Because, you know, what's aesthetically appealing about improvisation is that everybody's pushing themselves to their limit and that you get to be a part of that. You're in the room, and just by being in the room, you're a part of what the performers are responding to in a much more visceral way than I think you are in a, you know, if you're going to a truly scripted theater play or, you know, a classical concert.
Yeah, completely. So you play jazz trumpet.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big jazz trumpet fan, I want to hear your favorite sort of improvised jazz trumpet performance. And I'm going to tell you mine real quick. It was right after I graduated college, and I was doing the backpacking around Europe thing with my friend Steve, and we were in Carcassonne, France, and these two street musicians asked us if they wanted money, and we gave them money to play a Django Reinhardt song, and they're like, "Are you going to the concert?" And we're like, "What concert?" And they're like, "Come with us." And as we sort of turn in this medieval fortress city, I hear this, you know, sort of unmistakable muted horn sound. And Miles Davis was giving a free concert out in the sort of big grassy area. And he kept his back to the audience the entire time he was playing. But it was like one of the most amazing experiences I've ever had. And oh, my God, to see, you know, Miles even in that late period was something.
That sounds fantastic. So, I mean, that would have been my favorite too if I had been around there. Everyone who's heard me play, I give them one guess as to my son's name.
Yeah, there's and okay.
Pretty much everyone gets it because my son's name is Miles. So I mean, he was definitely my favorite. I mean, for performances that are recorded, you know, I love the 1964 My Funny Valentine live performances.
Yeah.
And there's some great 1969 ones. And in terms of what I've seen, boy, that's such a hard question because, you know, they're all great for really different reasons. I mean, this isn't trumpet, but I think the favorite live performance I saw was when Wayne Shorter and Herbie Hancock were touring for their duo album a few years back, and I got to hear them at Jordan Hall, which was the New England Conservatory performance hall, which is a surprisingly good place to hear purely acoustic music. So, you know, a lot of times jazz in a concert hall doesn't sound quite right because the acoustics are a little off, especially if you have amplification. But they were purely acoustic. You can stand up on stage and you can hear every little part of it. And it was terrific.
And I'm curious in terms of what came first, your love of sort of jazz and understanding improvisation, and then that kind of bled into the sort of, you know, world you found yourself in business school, or was there did you just how did that path work?
So yeah, it's a funny path, and I think it's appropriate for the sort of yes and theme of the podcast because it was purely serendipitous in so many ways. So. I was down, so I did what most people do if you graduate from music school in Boston, which is move down to New York. And I was playing a little bit down New York and kind of commuting. And I had to, of course, have a day job, which for my main marketable skill besides music was apparently standardized tests. So I taught for Kaplan for a few years as I was kind of trying to make it in New York. And as I did that, you know, you keep taking different tests so you can teach more people. And so I took the GMAT so I could teach it. And it turns out after you do it for a few years, you get pretty darn good at it.
Mm-hmm.
And And then, and so simultaneously, I'm going, you know, like, I'm probably going to go to graduate school of some kind. What kind is that going to be? Am I going to, you know, keep doing music and do musicology, or am I going to try and do something else? Because I've, you know, got all these skills with taking various standardized tests and the GMAT and the LSAT and the GRE or whatever it is. As I was also doing this master's degree at where we can sort of make up our own majors, and I was trying to look at it, compare different kinds of improvised musics with some improvisation in different sorts of artistic contexts. And as I was doing that, I found this work on the psychology of creativity by a woman named Teresa Amabile, who at the time I didn't know the significance of that. And I sort of looked up where she was, and it turned out she wasn't in the psychology department. She was in the business school and was in this field called organizational behavior that I had never heard of before. And, you know, sort of foolishly or hubristically, I just, you know, was like, oh, well, I have this idea that improvisation could, you know, studying improvisation would be interesting for anyone, and here's my ideas about it. And I wrote them down and applied to the doctoral program there. And strangely, they let me in. And then at the other end of that, you become a business school professor. Wow. And some stuff happened in between there, obviously. But so it was really, I was interested in improvisation. And that's always been what has driven pretty much all of my research interests. Although, you know, sometimes in some of the papers, it gets a little hard to see how it's connected. But if you ask me, like, how did you start studying helping, or how did you start studying you know, shared leadership or some of the other topics that I've worked on, I can sort of trace it back to some aspect of improvisation that I was interested in. I was interested in timing. I was interested in this sort of dynamic process where an outsider is coming in and looking at the situation and then has to act that you have to do when you're helping.
Yep.
Or coaching a team, and that all of them kind of come back to that for me. So I've always been improvisation first, and that I've been very fortunate that people want to hear about it and are also curious about it in organizational behavior.
Yeah. So in one of the papers you wrote about is improvisation and mediation. And this makes perfect sense because I'll quote you from the paper. You say, in jazz and theater improvisations, the musicians and actors must listen not only to each other and to themselves, but also to the audience. And this is so crucial when you're improvising, because you are taking into account the audience's reaction at any given time. And when you're in a mediation, you can't just be listening to, you know, what you're saying or what the person across from you is saying. Dan Pink kind of said when he's in a negotiation, when I interviewed him, he said, you know, sometimes you have to just listen for where the yes is, and that might not be in what is actually being said. So there's other things going on in a room, and I think that's kind of what you're getting at around why you might use improvisational skills in a mediation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think mediators and negotiators of all kinds are really interested in this concept, because it is, as we were sort of saying earlier, a situation where it's really hard to unsay things, and that the consequences of what you do are so interpersonal and they're so immediate that understanding it as an improvisation, I think, is really helpful to people. And then to sort of draw on traditions like jazz or theater improvisers, where there's sort of a way to think about what that even means. Whereas, you know, if you go in to being a negotiator, you know, certainly 20 years ago, there wasn't that many ways to think about it other than a very sort of hyper-rational way of doing that. And so I think people are really curious for that, who have to do this a lot in their work. And they found it valuable to sort of draw lessons from jazz and theater, and then to even sort of think about what improvisation looks like in their discipline.
Right. Okay, I do want to talk to you about, you've written on IDEO a lot, and I've worked with them, and that's something I want to cover. But before that, I was looking up your work, and I found a paper that's not really about improvisation, but man, it fascinated me, and it's about decision-making. And you wrote this a couple years back about in-process interventions in decision-making groups. So this is something that anyone who works in business deals with, right? Groups come together to decide something, which in and of itself is like a nightmare all the time. But you examined how the actual timing of presenting new information affects the actual decision-making process. And I'm wondering if you can unpack that a little bit for us.
Yeah, so I can trace these all back to improvisation.
Great, please do.
Again, because, it was, we were looking at the team coaching interventions, and we were, my other advisor, Richard Hackman, had been working with U.S. intelligence agencies on doing these sort of interagency intelligence analysis,
yeah.
And they've been trying to train the leaders of these teams to, in the sort of best practices around team leadership. And he was saying, they're very smart people, they're getting all the messages, but then, they go into the room and they just have no sense of timing, and we don't know anything about timing this. And to me, that's basically the same improvisational skills that we're talking about. It's about noticing, it's about situational awareness, and the ability to both read and act simultaneously. And so I said, hey, I want to study that. And that ended up being what my dissertation was about. And this study that you're talking about was saying, well, it doesn't do any good to say, here's what predicts timing. Here I can tell you whether people are going to do things earlier or later. And it only does us any good if we also know there are consequences to that.
Right.
And so this study was about, what are the consequences of doing things at different times in group interaction? The big finding from that research was, not what we thought at the beginning. It was that there's a huge difference from right before people start interacting and trying to give them advice, but they still haven't started, and even just a few seconds or minutes into their discussion, they're much more receptive to the same advice. And that people, share way more information, make better decisions, even though they're, the difference between the two interventions might be just a minute.
Isn't that interesting?
And so
do you think that's like in the same way, if we're thinking improvisationally, the need to at least set up, what the structure is of the chord progression before you improvise away from it?
Yeah, I think that's a good metaphor for it. That it's like, especially with group interaction,
mm-hmm.
we're very bad at sort of prospectively thinking about what that's going to be like, what it's really going to be like with any group of people doing any particular task is very abstract until it starts.
Mm-hmm.
But once it's started, then, people are actually very sophisticated about, like, oh, I know what's going on. We're very sophisticated perceivers of social situations.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you give people this advice, they can see why it's useful. Whereas when they're sort of thinking when we haven't started interacting yet, people have more trouble saying, oh, I understand what's going to be useful about this. I know how I'm going to use it. And they might be worried about a lot of other things like, are people going to agree with me? What am I going to say?
Right.
But then once you're in it, it's, a lot of those things drop away very quickly.
And we should note that you had three interventions. One was pre-task, one was about 5 minutes in, mm-hmm. and then another was like midway through the meeting. And the midway through the meeting didn't mm-hmm. work either.
Well, it worked just as well as 5 minutes.
Oh, it did? Okay.
And so the finding there was it didn't really, I would have thought there was a too late.
Yeah.
In that particular task, we didn't find one. But basically, intervening a minute in the second study, or 5 minutes in, or 15 minutes in, all had about the same effects.
Interesting.
In that one. But the big difference was, between just before to any time during.
Yeah. You have a quote there, too, which is not all minutes are created equal, which I kind of liked. I think that's a good thing to live by. Okay. So you co-wrote a piece for Harvard Business Review about IDEO's culture of helping. And the first line of the mm-hmm. piece is great. You wrote, quote, "Few things leaders can do are more important than encouraging helping behavior within their organization." And I've always believed that to be true. But what does the science tell us about that?
I mean, the science is pretty on board with that more helping is good for the organization or unit, and that there's some subtlety to this, too. And I'm sure you've read Adam Grant's work on the give and take and all this, that there's costs for individuals.
Yeah.
When we think about asking for help and providing help. But if you're thinking more about the social system or the whole organization, organizations that have more helping tend to do better than organizations that have less. That said, a lot of the work we've done since then also says that how you provide that help matters as well. And it's certainly not just the quantity of help. But Yeah, as organizations that are doing more creative work, more knowledge work, as we have roles that, you know, are fuzzier, so what does it mean to be the manager or the team leader, and that, as that gets kind of blurred with other kinds of responsibilities like it is at IDEO, helping takes on a really important role in how we just get work done.
Right. And the thing is that what happens, I think there's this sort of societal belief that, you know, there's shame in asking for help or there's fear. And I always think back, we interviewed Charles Lim on the broadcast, who did, when he was at Johns Hopkins, did that study of improvisers inside an fMRI machine, and noted that the part of the brain that's the sort of fear or shame part of the brain goes down when you're actually improvising. And I think that, you know, what you talk about at IDEO is that you say, quote, there's no shame in asking for help, and that psychological safety shows up on many levels. And that's really it, right? It's giving your people psychological safety.
Yeah, you know, to destigmatize asking for help is very, very important if you're going to have work with any uncertainty whatsoever. And I mean, it's really hard to imagine even doing, you know, academic work where we're writing papers, and it's really hard to know how good a paper is until somebody else looks at it, and that it's very easy to lose perspective when you're doing creative work, when you're doing anything that's unfamiliar or very knowledge intensive and complicated. It's not always self-evident whether what you need, whether it's good or not, and you need this outside input.
Yeah.
But then on the other side, getting that outside input does require some of this kind of improvisational skill where, again, you have to look at somebody else's situation, get on board with what they're thinking very quickly, and respond in a way that they're going to find helpful. And what we're currently working on, sort of following all this up, is that that's not always the case, and that there are a lot of conditions under which people can mess up these helping interactions such that people aren't finding the help very helpful.
I thought it was interesting, too, that you noted in this piece that, quote, trust and accessibility mattered much more than competence. I think that would be surprising to people.
Yeah, I think that was it was surprising to us as well, where part of it is that, you know, at IDEO they have a lot of mutual respect there, and so the overall respect for people's competence there was high. So it was rare for somebody to say, oh yeah, you know, that person's not very good at their job. But trust and accessibility definitely trump perceptions of expertise or competence, and there's been other research that's also had very similar findings on that. So that seems like it's true, and it's very consonant with psychological safety, which you mentioned, where you don't want to feel like you're bothering somebody when you ask for help. And so making yourself seem accessible as a leader or somebody who's, you know, just trying to be helpful in an organization is a really important step in that process.
And there was one other thing in the piece that I wanted to ask you about, because you talk about this idea of allowing slack inside organizations. So what's the importance of having slack?
I mean, slack, you know, so many people, the students that we see when we talk to MBAs or executives who are working right now, and that everyone's as busy as they possibly can be. That, you know, if you're not at capacity, then usually people start taking on more tasks, or your manager starts asking you to do more.
Yeah.
And that there's some dysfunction to that when we have any kind of uncertainty in the work. Mm-hmm. So if we sort of can acknowledge, like improvisers often do, that we don't know everything that needs to be done, that we can't plan our way out of every situation, you're going to need slack. And that's what provides these sort of serendipitous moments for people to bump into each other in the halls and think something that they wouldn't see, for people to make themselves accessible. There's no way to do that if there's not slack in the organization.
Yeah, I that's certainly something I've experienced, because, you know, and Adam Grant talks about this too, you know, that there can be power in sort of daydreaming and using those sort of moments just to kind of work something out. And we certainly know in the arts, creatively, like, we take our screwing around very importantly. And I know that's true for music, in terms of when you're just sort of picking around or jamming or whatever. It's certainly true in theater. We use those moments, and it might not even be that they're agendaless often, and that's where a lot of great stuff comes out of.
Yeah, absolutely. And that, you know, organizations have historically not been great at that.
No.
And there's really good reasons for that. I'm not saying everybody should switch from a efficiency mindset to providing tons and tons of Slack. It really depends what you're trying to accomplish.
Right.
But if you don't do any of that, especially when you're doing creative work or work where you're not sure what the right answer is going to be, that you do have to sort of shift your mindset into how we organize, and that one of those things is not scheduling everybody up to the brim so that people can make adjustments. They can do things spontaneously. They can make themselves available on other projects, so you're getting learning across different functions and parts of the organization.
Yeah, they got to find the ROI on Slack. I think it exists. It's just sort of finding it. All right, did we blow your yes and story earlier in the podcast?
Yeah, a little bit, but that's
okay. that's okay. Because I do. Well, here's what I do want to ask you. All right, so you're a relatively young man who has an academic career ahead of you, and you're very involved in sort of improvisational study. Where does this go? Where do you want to take the study of improvisation? Because we're involved in this a little bit with our friends at the University of Chicago, and I've talked about that on the podcast before. But are there things that you've got that you're like, oh man, in 10 or 15 years, I want to be able to prove this or studied this or moved in a different kind of direction?
Yeah, I think we're really doing a number of things on that front. So all day today I was working on a paper that's about the experience of improvising, which I think has gotten a little bit lost, and that sometimes it kind of dilutes the power of the concept when we start talking about whole organizations improvising.
Right.
Which can mean something very different from like what we say as artistic improvisers. When we're improvising, there's a certain psychology and kind of relationship between action and cognition that's going on. Mm-hmm. And that I think is more of a metaphor when we start to take that up to the whole organization. So what I'm working on something with my colleague Frank Barrett, where we're trying to put this idea of the experience of improvising back in, and to say, what's the role of this in other kinds of creativity that we see in organizations? So that my theory is basically that all creativity has at least some moment of improvisation in it somewhere.
Yep.
But that we're so good at telling the story of organizational life in terms of planning and intention and rationality, that I think when you ask people, you don't always get that story unless you can really look and unpack what they're doing in a different way. And that may require some sort of different kinds of assumptions. So we're kind of looking at, we're trying to figure out some ways to look at that and writing some papers that are along those lines. And then I think, the tools for studying change over time, to kind of move over into more quantitative work have really changed.
Yeah.
That, pure computing power and the way statistics work now have opened the door to thinking about dynamic systems and the way teams interact in a lot of different ways. Hmm. And so I think, the way we've been trying to model things like, how do we share leadership or accountability? How do ideas flow from people to people? That we can model those in much more complicated and dynamic ways now. That I think improvisation will have a lot to say about sort of how do we put boundaries around these very dynamic processes that are allowing people to coordinate like we do, something like yes and allows you to do, or like having harmonic and rhythmic structure does in jazz. What are the analogs to that when we're doing really dynamic kinds of knowledge intensive work in organizations like what IDEO does? And so I think we're sort of looking at those kind of things.
It's funny where we sit today with these kinds of studies going on that you're doing and that we're doing at Second City and with our partners. And my experience in my 30 years at Second City was like most people who got involved in improvisation were lazy because they didn't want to learn how to, memorize a script. And then develop this very, incredible work ethic once they get inside. But it's not how they entered the building. They entered completely, the other way. And I think that's the power of then actually doing the thing of being in the practice, is that you recognize, oh my God, this is giving me so much more that I don't just take on stage. I take it with me when I interact with my spouse or my kids or my colleagues or the rest of the world. And I would suggest that the reason so many famous people have come out of Second City is not because, you know, we've got sort of magic casting people, myself included. None of us are magic. It's that all these people have given a practice that allows them to be successful both in the art they're doing, but also in managing their own careers.
Yeah, I think that's a great insight. And I think it's a great question as to how does improvising change you?
Yeah.
That and that it clearly has. I mean, I think I could have easily been a super structured engineer type person in the way my brain works, but you know, discovering improvisation really, I think, changed a lot of things about my life, and just falling in love with hearing people create something that there's no way any one of them could have created, and that realization of that's what I found really appealing aesthetically, and then the experience of doing that, you know, it's just tremendous. And I don't see any way that people can do that and not feel changed in their own capacities by it. So I think that's a great insight that you're talking about.
Colin Fisher, thanks for coming on the show.
Okay, thank you, Kelly.
I'm up here for the